Welcome to another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Paff and Reggie Rizzou with you on today's episode, how ants can help reveal the key to sustainable energy sourcing. A youthful competitor for Einstein and Hawking, we'll explain, and one European district is taking advanced measures to protect against pet owners who don't clean up. Plus, on this day in history, the 400 is established. Coming up, Cool Stuff Ride Home. As the global pursuit for sustainable energy solutions intensifies, renewable fuels derived from biomass have emerged as a common choice. By the way, in case you're not familiar with the term, biomass is defined by Oxford as organic matter used as a fuel, especially in a power station, for the generation of electricity. That said, the continued cultivation of a single type of biomass has proven unsustainable, producing detrimental effects on the land itself as well as the animals that occupy it. In one recent study, detailed on a peer-reviewed science website Frontiers, scientists examined ant communities residing in various cropping systems and discovered that greater plant diversity fostered more plentiful, diverse, and effective ant communities. And while ants are obviously just one small piece of the ecosystems in which they live, the research highlights the importance of finding more sustainable ways to grow the crops needed to produce eco-friendlier fuel. So essentially, we can't continue to rob Peter to pay Paul here. The damage we could end up causing the environments in which this biomass is grown and harvested may negate the eco-friendly gains made from using it as fuel. And while biofuel is a renewable energy source, something that typically comes with a positive connotation, its usage is still somewhat controversial. The cultivation of a limited number of high-yield crops for fuel purposes can result in the loss of biodiversity within the cropping systems responsible for biomass production. By the way, I know this isn't a term or phrase we hear about every day. A cropping system encompasses the specific crops grown in a particular area, their sequence, and the management practices employed on the field in which they're grown. So, back to the study. Scientists in the U.S. conducted a comparative analysis of ant communities across various bioenergy cropping systems to gain insights into how these systems influence the surrounding ecosystem. They examined 10 unique bioenergy cropping systems in an experimental array in Michigan. The systems included annual crops like corn and two types of broom corn, the latter of which does not look like corn at all. It's actually used to create brooms, and thus the name. Simple perennial systems, perennial meaning crops that live longer than a single year, and diverse perennial systems. Now, the researchers captured almost 10,000 individual ants belonging to 22 species in this study. In complex ecosystems, ants carried out more functional roles, for example, predator or seed disperser, than in simple systems. Species richness was highest in diverse and lowest in simple systems. Community composition also differed. Some common ant species were found in all cropping systems. Rarer species, however, only showed up in plant-diverse perennial systems. Now, per the study's first author, Dr. Nathan Hahn of the University of Kentucky, quote, "We found different ant communities when we compared annual crops, perennial systems, and diverse perennial polycultures with many plant species. Perennial bioenergy cropping systems, particularly those that incorporate more plant diversity, give rise to a different and more diverse ant community than simpler systems," end quote. In lay terms, that last statement is the important one. The greater the diversity of crops, the greater the diversity of ants. So, you might be asking yourself, why focus on ants for this study? Well, ants have an important role in agricultural ecosystems as well as grasslands. They can occupy a number of roles, including predators, typically of other insects, seed dispersers, and soil engineers. Per Hahn, quote, "If large parts of our landscapes become dedicated to growing crops for fuel, ants are a top candidate to investigate how insect communities could differ from crop to crop," end quote. Per the researchers, the crops tested in this study have various pros and cons for biofuel production. Some of them are more productive but have little conservation value. Others are less productive but have conservation benefits. As an example, perennials can help store carbon below ground in their roots. Mixed species prairies can also be very productive and are much more biodiverse, but there are more unknowns about how to use their biofuel biomass to actually generate the appropriate end products. Once again, per Han, quote, it's a matter of understanding trade-offs and figuring out how to optimize them. There are a range of other cropping systems that could be adopted and become mainstays. We need to understand which of these are biodiversity friendly and which are not, end quote. The researchers hope their study will inform decisions about which crops can be used for sustainable biofuel production, where those crops are grown, and how they are managed. We'll link to this story in today's show notes so you can check it out and learn a little bit more beyond what we've talked about here if you are so inclined. So, Reggie, I guess this goes back to how nothing in this life is really easy. We, of course, want to shift towards biofuel for the purposes of keeping the environment intact, which I think is a noble, certainly, cause and something that's a necessity at this point. But at the same time, need to find a way to not tear it down in the process of harvesting these products for fuel.
Growing up in a farming community, maybe I'm misinterpreting the story, but yeah, it is important to rotate your crops, which is, I believe, what you were saying in the farm management system. So yeah, sometimes you grow the biodegradable fuel production crops. Other times you switch off to corn. Like, I know a lot of farmers, you know, go between corn and beans. Maybe there's subsidies you could hand out to farmers, because they do that a lot of times, of every 3 years you grow the crops for biomass fuels, but you only get that every so often to make sure you're not continually doing it, to keep that, I guess, diversity intact.
Yeah, for sure. Whatever the case might be, it requires a certain level of thought and planning. At least that seems apparent based on this story, whether they're rotating throughout various farms or different parts of the country, or whether they're finding a way to maximize what they're getting out of particular areas, and they keep going back to the same field or the same farm or the same area, whatever you want to call it. If you're doing that, making sure you are rotating your crops appropriately, but at the same time, of course, producing crops that are actually worthy of fuel production. And that seems to be the single biggest key here is yeah, we can rotate crops, but they're not all built the same for creating biomass. So how do you continue to get that same level of productivity from your crops while continuously rotating them?
Yeah, and you had that great example of the one crop that leaves carbon in the ground, because every crop is going to take nutrients away, but leave others. So that's the importance for rotating them, is you want to make sure you're not taking too much of one thing out at a time and maybe replacing it with other crops that come in. So yeah, I get this. This all makes sense. Well, mostly makes sense. Let's put it that way. There is a new member of Mensa, and he matched the scores of Einstein and Stephen Hawking. Best part is, the new member is only 12 years old. Cyrus Leung of Sheffield, England, scored 160, only getting two questions wrong on the intelligence test. Cyrus is, quote, very proud, which I think he should be. So good job, Cyrus. When talking to BBC Look North, Cyrus also added, I didn't expect to get a high score like that. I didn't believe it. The test was quite easy, but there were a couple difficult questions, end quote. According to his dad, Frank, Cyrus mastered the times table by the age of 3. He is also quoted in saying that Cyrus was keen to challenge himself and see whether he could get into the Mensa Society. He's got such a gift, it's my responsibility to help him achieve the maximum he can achieve, end quote. When he's not becoming a member of Mensa, Cyrus spends his time, of course, at school, playing chess and video games along with the piano. So he sounds like a normal 12-year-old boy to me. Well, I guess not all 12-year-old boys play chess, but the video game, school, learning an instrument, that all makes sense. As for his future, he is thinking of becoming either a mathematician or a data scientist. He likes data scientists because it combines his favorite subjects from school, and he thinks it sounds like fun to work with AI to solve problems. So, Marcus, have you taken your Mensa test yet?
No, and I don't plan to. I don't know that I need to learn.
Be insulted like that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be light years behind old Cyrus here, but I'm a little surprised that he's not moving along in school a little quicker, given how intelligent he is. But I also understand the need to maintain a somewhat normal life and have your friends and your social network too. So that seems like he's very well adjusted for being such a smart guy.
I like his quote that the test was quite easy, but there were a couple difficult questions. I mean, obviously, I've never looked at a Mensa test. I haven't taken one, but I would hope that most of the test wasn't quite easy for most of us.
I'm assuming not. But yeah, I mean, again, good on Cyrus for getting it done. I wonder, did it say what prompted him to give this a shot?
He wanted to try to be in Mensa Society, and his dad, you know, helped him along and took the test. So it's just something he wanted to see if he could do it.
Well, in 10 to 15 years, I'll be on the lookout for Cyrus Leung, because I expect he will be doing some great things with that big brain of his. Congrats, Cyrus. If you listen to this show with regularity, you know I am a dog lover. But one thing I don't love, irresponsible owners who don't clean up after their pets. Well, one province in Italy is doing something about that, adopting DNA tests as a solution to address the issue of dog waste in its streets. Once a dog DNA registration database is up and running, street cleaners and health officials in Bolzano will be able to collect abandoned feces, have it genetically tested and traced back to the owners, who will face fines of between 50 and 500 euros. That's approximately 54 to 540 US dollars. And don't think you could just avoid the registration database, even though I'm sure some people will try. Any owner who refuses the DNA profiling with their dog will face fines of 292 to 1,048 euros. Very nice round numbers. That's approximately 315 US dollars to a little over 1,130 US dollars. Per Reuters, the provincial government covering Bolzano City and surrounding towns in the Dolomites region is creating the database for almost 40,000 dogs in the area, and about 10,000 have already been registered. Paolo Zambato, the veterinary department director, said, quote, "Bolzano receives a few hundred complaints a year from citizens about improper management of public land. More than half are for dogs. Law enforcement could only catch three or four of them because they have to go there and set up some kind of stakeout," end quote. I can't imagine being asked to go out on stakeout just to see what's happening with a particular individual's dog and if they're cleaning up, but here we are. DNA registration will become mandatory in late March. Owners will be expected to have blood tests for their dogs, either in municipal dog shelters or vet clinics. There was not an estimated cost for the project, but the detection administration expenses are expected to be covered from the fines. So I have to say, Reggie, as someone who lives in a neighborhood in the Las Vegas area, in Henderson, I see this far too often. We do have rules as set forth or put forth by our HOA, but people still leave behind dog feces all the time, and it drives me insane as someone who is committed to cleaning up after my two dogs. So I'm down with this. I would love to implement it in my neighborhood so we could put an end to this.
First, I'm skeptical that the expenses are going to be covered by the fines. I mean, you're going to have to get everyone tested. Unless you're making everyone pay for their own testing, you're going to have to get all those dogs tested, and then you're going to have the database. There's going to have to be some management. Someone's going to be in charge of that. You're going to have somebody out there to administer the fees. This doesn't sound like a cheap project or task to have on hand. I know it sounds boring to have a stakeout of seeing if a dog's, you know, doing who knows what in someone's yard, but I don't know. See, that seems like a great excuse just to sit back, eat a meal, take a relaxing break from your job for a little bit if you're an officer.
Okay, we're talking about preserving funds. You're going to pay two officers to sit out all night doing nothing, take them away from other things just so they can sit back, have a meal, and wait for a dog to come out?
I mean, if it's a slow community, I mean, it sounds like if they're already doing those stakeouts, there's not a lot going on. If there's a lot going on, that's a low priority stakeout. So I doubt there's too much going on already.
Well, I got to believe going into this, they're looking at the number of complaints that arise. They're seeing how many times they could potentially have issued fines and making a determination about the funds based off of that number. Now, if this goes into effect and at some point they feel like, hey, it's done its job, people are actually cleaning up, maybe you could pull back a little bit and you don't have to dedicate so much of your financial resources to such a thing. That said, if it's a slower community and this is one of the top priorities there or one of the preeminent annoyances of the community, I'm for it. You know what? If I lived there, I'd pay a little bit of my money to be in on this.
What if it's not in a dog or an, you know, what if you have a spiteful neighbor that's doing this? What if it's a cat that gets outside? You know what? Goose poop looks a lot like small dog poop.
Well, it's going to come back. I mean, you're not going to have it in the database at that point. I would assume that somebody like a veterinarian could identify the difference, Reggie. I mean, they may look close to you and I, But my wife works in the veterinary field and she knows a lot more about this stuff than I do.
I don't know. I mean, having had clean up other people's animals from my yard, it's annoying, but to spend money on it, I don't know. I don't know. To me, it's not worth it.
I'm here for it. Give it, bring it on. I'll spend my dollars. Knock it off, people. Be responsible.
Taking a look at this day in history, it was on February 1st, 1892, that Miss William Astor invited 400 guests to her grand ball in her mansion, which started the use of the 400 to describe the socially elite during the height of the Gilded Age. It was Ward McAllister, a friend and confidant of Miss Astor and a social arbiter, that coined the phrase the 400. Now, it all started after the Civil War when the population of New York grew as immigrants and wealthy families from the Midwest moved to the city and challenged the dominance of the New York establishment. Miss Astor and McAllister took on the responsibility of deciding who was important. Now, some reports say that only 400 people were invited to the ball because that's all her ballroom could hold. In several other papers, it was rumored that only 150 people were actually invited. In an article by the New York Times, McAllister cleared up that statement. By the way, as I read his quote here, see if you can spot the crutch phrase that he uses while speaking. Quote, the so-called 400 has not been cut down or dwindled to 150 names. The nonsense, don't you know? Printed to the effect in The World and some other papers has made a very bad impression that will reflect badly against them, you understand? That list of names, you understand, printed on Sunday, did not come from me, don't you see? It is unauthorized, don't you see? But it is accurate as far as it goes, you understand? It is incomplete and does injustice, you understand, to many eligible millionaires. Think of leaving out such names, don't you know, as Chauncey M. Depew, General Alexander S. Webb, Mr. and Mrs. Edward Cooper, Mr. and Mrs. Luther Kuntz, Mr. and Mrs. Robert Goulet, Mr. Goulet. And Mrs. Wilson, Miss Green, and many others. Don't you understand? It's absurd. Senseless. Let me explain, don't you know? There are three other dinner dances, don't you know, during the season, and the invitations, don't you see, are issued to different ladies and gentlemen each time. Do you understand? So at each dinner dance, you know, are only 150 people of the highest set, don't you know? So during the season, you see 400 different invitations are issued. Wait a moment, and I will give you the correct list, don't you know, of the people who form what is known as the 400. Do you understand? Will be authorized, reliable, and, don't you know, the only correct list. Could you spot a few of his crutches there, Marcus?
I sure could. And boy, that was the longest quote I've ever heard in my life.
I felt wow. Read it all because the crutches and the, I don't know how
you're to say it. You're high society and you can't knock off the don't you know and you understand every five yeah, seconds. Not
exactly.
Even, every 0.5 seconds. Man, it makes me happy I didn't live around that time where the, look, we still have social classes, but this was to the nth degree.
And after he released that list of names of the 400, several papers took to nicknaming McAllister as Mr. Make-A-Lister. not the most creative insulting name, but you know, it's out there. And a few years later in 1888, McAllister also told the New York Tribune he felt there were only 400 people in New York that really mattered. People who were at the ease in a ballroom of high society, quote, if you go outside that number, you strike people who are not either at ease in a ballroom or make other people not at ease, end quote.
The horror.
I know. Needless to say, I am not a member of the 400, and I'm not sure if I would want to be.
No, get me out of there. I mean, that's pinkies up type stuff, you know, when sipping your tea or whatever it might be. I have no desire or would have no desire to be involved in that type of a club. You understand.
Yeah. Don't you know, the snootiness of the whole attitude is part of the reason why I grabbed this story. I wish I could do a good accent like that. Like, don't you know? Let me explain.
Oh, man. If I ever spoke to this guy, I would have to drop some of his crutches into my language as well, just to see if he picked up on that.
So Mrs. Astor and McAllister are both in the movie The Gilded Age, if you want to see what modern interpretation they have of them.
Okay, have to check that out. I've yet to see it.
Thanks for joining us on another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. If you have any comments, thoughts, you can reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram as well. I'm Reggie Rizzou, joined as always by Marcus Paff. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Cool Stuff Ride Home.